And if we need to pause or start anything over, I'll let you know. I know in the last podcast I did, I was fine. Just like 2 minutes in, I got a little tongue tied. So I like took a deep breath and started, and we were fine. And we actually went for 2 hours, which is far too long. I won't make you suffer through that. I'm not in the mood for tormenting people. That's something we're doing on Mondays, not Fridays.
Well, I absolutely don't feel tormented so far. I'll update you if that changes. In the meantime, don't even worry about it. The cool thing about this podcast is that, first of all, it's still low in the listens. So if you fuck this up, or I do, no one cares. It's like 30 people are going to be like, skip. No problem. So no pressure at all. Second of all, that's not going to happen because there's no formality to this. I don't write any questions. I'm not looking to, get canned answers from you that fit well into anything. I just want to talk to you. I just want to get to know you. And one of the cool things is that sometimes this show is like, I'm getting to know people I thought I already knew, and I ask them some deeper questions. And before I know it, I'm like, wow, this is like a brand new person that I'm meeting. But you are a brand new person that I'm meeting. I don't know anything about you other than you went to School of the Arts, which is the whole point of this show that we do, is that's the only prerequisite. So Chloe, thank you for talking to me.
Oh yeah. Thanks for having me. I already like you, because I love the artsy shirt. I forgot the name of the artist that's based off of, but you look like the Brooklyn hipster I aspire to be. So,
oh my God, that is so sweet. Well, I'm in Los Angeles, so I'm a bit of a mixed cookie, but, I'm going to take that compliment 100%. So let's start the only question that I do have, the only one that I impose on everyone, which is, where are you from, Chloe?
Well, I had a bit of a nomadic upbringing, but I spent most of I lived in 4 different states growing up. I think I moved 18 times, but it was mostly around the Hudson Valley area, which is this very like scenic area, lots of hiking, easy access to the city. Right now I'm in Peekskill, and I've become a bit of a local character because I'm known as the TikTok girl, or the girl who makes those silly commercials, as the boomers call it. Because I run the social media accounts for a third of the local businesses.
That is a lot.
People see me doing crazy things with my stabilizer. Like the other day, I did a Hansel and Gretel gingerbread house. I don't know fairy tales. I should. One of my clients is a fairy tale storyteller, but I digress. So I was leaving all of these business cards all around town for a video. And people were honestly looking at me like, do you need some mental health assistance? And I was like, no, I'm just like a TikTok marketer. This is what we do. I also dress up like an inflatable latte and run around town.
I do that anyway. I don't get paid for it though, so I hope you do. Mine's purely pro bono. You said you moved in around a whole bunch of different areas and states, but it's mostly surrounding the like New York tri-state area kind of. Are you, how much, where, what are the 4 states? Where did you go? New York,
obviously North Carolina. My mom migrated down with me for UNCSA so I could get in state. Thanks, mom.
Did you go to you went to the high school program for dance?
Oh no, I went to the college program.
Just college. Okay. Because a lot of those stories of like my mom moved with me to North Carolina is like to get in that high school spot where they give you the full hookup if you live there. So that's why I jumped to that conclusion. So did you were doing ballet or modern then?
I actually switched concentrations. So, and the other two states I previously lived in were Connecticut and Florida. But it's funny because my mom did migrate with me to Staten Island for 2 years so I could go to the professional performing arts school for high school because I had already been a scholarship at the Ailey School. Yeah, I don't know why my camera's doing this panning thing.
It's kind of fun. Love it. We've got a nice dynamic. I feel like I've got a camera person in the room. If you're listening to this only, please go watch the video. It's a lot of fun. We got some dynamic angles changing here without anyone switching hands. You were saying.
Oh yes. Let me get my,
you went to PPAS
centered. I did go cause I was already, a scholarship student in the junior division of the Ailey School. So I used to be like that crazy, high schooler, up here in the Hudson Valley in Highland Falls. And my mom would pick me up from AP history at world history, at 1:55 PM. And I'd have to rush to get the 2:09 PM train into the city. Then I traveled. And then I do the evening classes, and then I travel an hour and a half backup. So that was quite an odyssey. And because MTA is so underfunded, our trains have been the same since the 1980s. So it's very nostalgic for me to take those trains these days. But then that was for sophomore year. Then for junior and senior, we met the director of the PPAS ALE dance program. And he's like, oh, you know, she's great. We'd love to have her. So we moved to Staten Island because you have to live within one of the five boroughs. And then I did the hellish Staten Island commute, which was a train to a boat to another train. But Staten Island is like a wondrous culture of sequined purses, or at least it was when I was there in 2011. Spray tans, mob wives kind of references and fake nails. It's like and turkeys all over the place for some reason, even though there's no other wildlife. It's just like one of the most special places in the world. I highly recommend it for anyone. 5 out of 5 stars for Staten Island.
It's a wild place. And I this is the thing that I'll tell you that we kind of shared together, which is I'm not originally from New York. I'm from Texas, but I went to high school at Talent Unlimited, which is that D-list performing arts high school in Manhattan.
Sinatra. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, right. Cut, clip, post. I grew up in Texas and then eventually like worked my way into that weird world of like inner city high school performing arts. Cause there's a bunch, right? If those listening haven't heard it before, I'm sure it's come up many times, but I went to a school on the East Side called Talent Unlimited. We just talked about PPAS, the professional performing arts school, a lot of school, the arts people through that school as well. Never met another Talent Unlimited kid, but also went to School of the Arts ever. But you'll also recognize the LaGuardia School. There's a bunch of these schools that are specifically for high school that give you an almost collegiate experience in the city because you're commuting in a way like you would in a college experience. A lot of times the arts classes are elevated in skill level and the people you're already getting that conservatory thing. And I remember thinking to myself, I would go to class and I would have people in my class who were commuting from Staten Island. And I thought to myself, I'm coming from Hell's Kitchen at like a night for, this is a little inside for non New York people, but I'm literally coming from like 9th and 37th going to like 2nd and 60 something. It's nothing. It's like the smallest commute in New York City. And I'm like, this is a pain in the ass. That's like 45 minutes. And meanwhile, there's chicks in my class who took a fucking boat to school. That's crazy. A boat. What is this? 1845? And you're doing this every day for a whole year?
Yeah, I used to have to wake up at 5:30 in the morning. I'd get
that's wild, dude.
Train because I was in New Dorp, so that's kind of mid island to St. George, which is the top of the island. Then I'd take the ferry and pray there's not fog. I would be marked officially as late whenever the ferry was late due to fog, and I'm like, this is not fair. This is Mother Nature. There was nothing I could do. But anyway, and then I'd have to take, that Hurricane Sandy actually happened when I was at PPIS. The one train station was closed for a bit. That was dramatic. It was a brand new $300 million station, that closed like a year into its tenure. Thanks, Sandy. I take the one train or the two or three up to Hell's Kitchen. That's where I commuted. I would have my academic classes, my dog probably wants food, so be warned. I would have my academic classes from 8:30 to 1, and then I'd walk up to ALE and I'd do the PPAS classes from 1:15 to 4:30, and then I'd do the junior division, the private ALE program, from 4:30 to 7 or 8 p.m. on Fridays, and then I would commute all the way back and get home at midnight. And this was also a unique time for me because, unfortunately, my mom and I had, as I mentioned, moved around a lot. Occasionally we had to live with friends and everything because it was a little chaotic because my dad was terminally ill with dementia for much of my adolescent years. He lost the ability to walk and talk by the time I was 15, and he was hospitalized from then on. And then he passed away 10 years ago this Earth Day while I was on the Staten Island ferry commuting to school. And I got to school that day. He had been in hospice. I had seen him a few days before, and even they allowed us to sleep over at the hospice, which they don't allow anymore due to COVID rules. Cause unfortunately I had another friend pass away at the same hospice, during in 2020, but, I go to school, And school's fine. We had the PPAS gala that evening, Monday, April 22nd, 2013. And as we're rehearsing at ALE, I noticed my mom comes, and I knew she was coming anyway because she was going to go see the show. It was at a different location. I forgot the name of the theater in Midtown on like West 55th near the West Side Highway, or like, no, it was lower. Anyway. So she comes in and I'm pulled out of class into the crowded ALE hallway in their new build. We call it the new building, even though it's been around for like 20 years or whatever. Because they used to be closer to LaGuardia, I think, back in like the 90s. So if you're familiar with that space, it's basically an open layout lobby and there's constant traffic. So in this crowded space, my mom pulls me aside and says, "Your dad died at 7:40 a.m. or whatever it was." And I was just in shock. And then she drives me to the theater and I'm still kind of just like in absolute shock. And my director, the director of the ALE PPAS program, he's like, "Come on, Chloe, I know you can do this. I know you can pull it together. It's what your dad would have wanted. And that's what my mom was saying. The show must go on." So there's actually a video out there of me performing that day. And you can just tell even from the crappy, 250 or 350 pixel video that my spirit is just completely broken. Like my eyes are dead. Sure. So that was kind of one of, that was perhaps the most defining day and moment of my life. And I remember the weather was just so absolutely gorgeous that day. It was kind of like a bit of a cruel irony. So a lot of my time at UNCSA, unfortunately, was defined by me recently losing my dad.
I have a couple of follow-up questions, if you don't mind me asking. The first one is, how old are you now?
I'm 27.
Okay, that wasn't the first question. That's an extra. At 27, as you look back on that experience, you know, I think it's a very specific thing that I cannot personally relate to, losing a parent when you're still a child. But I have talked to countless people about it, unfortunately, that have had that experience. And I find it, you know, something that everyone responds to very differently. It affects their life, obviously, very differently based on their perspective at the time. And my question to you, Chloe, is, you were in that, "I'm still a kid, but I'm behaving like a professional adult artist. Go, 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 create, create, perform, do, do, do." There are a lot of people at the same age that you were at. You were 17? Mm-hmm. There are a lot of 17-year-olds all over the world who are just starting to figure out how to spend their time doing fucking anything. Anything. Like maybe they go to school, maybe they give a shit, maybe they pay attention at all. You're not living that life. Your life is a very, very full, as you just expressed. At 27, as you look back on that, how do you think that affected your experience of losing a parent? I'm not even looking for a, was it good? Was it bad? It was bad, obviously. But was it, how was that, do you think, different now that you've gained some perspective? And obviously you're not going, 18 hours a day dancing in this time in your life. Right. So what are your thoughts on that now with a bit of distance?
You should be a therapist or a life coach. I say that.
My wife's the therapist. So we've got that covered as a couple.
Oh yes. Oh, so that makes sense with that dynamic. that's a really fantastic question that no one's actually posed to me before. And in a way, it was a blessing and a curse. It was a blessing in that, so my dad had Lewy body dementia because he was older, significantly older. He was 68 when I was conceived. He told my mom he was like 50 and she was 36. So,
Whoa. I'll give you 1 second to process that, Chloe. Wow. That's like a lot. Wait, go back and do that one piece at a time. I'm so sorry. Pops was 68 when you were conceived, but that's 19, not how old you're.
1926. Yeah.
So but that's not how old your mom thought he was. Until when did she figure out how old he really was?
When I was 3, he comes up to me and he's like, "Okay, Chloe, don't tell your mom. You actually have 4 half siblings and not 2 because the 2 sisters were older than her." So he failed to mention their existence to her. And so I immediately, in my 3-year-old, self, I mean, I was a very independent 3-year-old. I once broke out of my preschool when we were in Connecticut and my dad was working. I think it was in Stanford. And we were playing in like the little play area, and there was a little hole in the fence. And I was like, you know what? I don't want to be here. So I literally escaped from preschool and I walked all the way to my dad's office and I made it to the elevator and I couldn't reach the button. And that's when someone was like, hold up.
Where did this child come from?
Meanwhile, my mom thinks that because my mom was a forensic psychologist, so she thinks I've been like kidnapped and assaulted and all the worst things imaginable from her patient's stories are infiltrating her mind. And then I get there and my dad's just like, oh, because I wanted to be with my dad. But yeah, I was a very independent and outspoken three-year-old. So immediately when my dad told me that I had four half siblings, I marched to my mom and she connected the dots.
So I'm sorry, I just need a second. You've had a lifetime to kind of process this and I'm still just figuring it out myself. This is fascinating. So you're saying that your dad confessed to you first as a three-year-old child that you were his second family that he was having in his life and that he had already had one with these other people and you're related to them and all that. You're the third kid, but it was the second family?
The fifth child.
So the half siblings were split amongst two different families he had had at different times. So you're the third family and your mom knew none of this and thought he was like 15 years younger than he was.
Well, she knew about my youngest half sibling. So the second.
Okay. The most recent.
Married kids.
But she didn't know about the first one.
But she didn't know about the first one because then she would have realized my half sisters are older than her. So she would have made the connection that he was actually 68.
How long? And I know we can move on if you want, but I'm so curious about this. How long were your parents together before you were conceived? Do you know that?
I think they were together for about 2 years. The reason my last podcast interview was considered one of the most unique is that, and my dad's story really weaves into my life as a marketer because I wouldn't be a marketer if it wasn't for him. And I've had the most unexpected path, as I'm often reminded, into running, you know, a six-figure business or whatever in marketing. But
okay, pause the marketing thing for one second because I just want to wrap up the very first question I asked. So,
oh, it connects back.
Okay, very good. Yeah, I just want to make sure that anyone listening doesn't feel like we lost track of that. Just the how it affected you. You said it was a curse and a gift at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I was absolutely like in love with my dad. He could do no wrong. I adored him. He adored me. I didn't even speak for the first years of my life until perhaps three when I became overly loquacious. Because I didn't need to, because he anticipated my every need. He was a bit crooked and not always the most honest. He was a really fabulous father to me. Incredibly, frighteningly charismatic. One of those people that walked into a room and all eyes would immediately be on him. A skilled schmoozer, brilliant, went to three Ivy Leagues, and incredibly funny. Like he did not take anything seriously. So he had such a big personality when the dementia hit, he became a shell of himself. I could still tell he would get so excited to see me. His eyes would get wide, but when you're a teenager and you are watching a parent degenerate and the roles switch from the parent caring for you to all of a sudden you're a child, but you have to be the caregiver for a parent, it's frightening. I think in a way it was good that I had dance. I didn't particularly love dance. My mom kind of aggressively pushed me into dance. And then I started like getting scholarships places and and a lot of artists can probably relate to this. It becomes your identity at some point that it's hard to let go. It's hard to admit like, hey, maybe I don't want to do this for the rest of my life. Maybe I don't have the body. I always knew I'm never going to be a prima ballerina. I'm never going to be the best dancer in a company, but maybe I can be, you know, good enough just to entertain some people, get paid. Because I like creating things and entertaining. In a way, I'm really grateful that the dance distracted me. So I didn't spend as much time. That conservatory training kept me occupied. So I didn't spend as much time with him when he was in the throes of that dementia, when he was struggling to talk, and when he was hospitalized in veterans hospitals and stuff. But at the same time, I also regret it because even though he was just a shell of his former self, he still was there. There would be moments, there's sundowning with dementia patients. So some days they're kind of alert and he had Lewy body, so it's more neuromuscular. But some days he'd be able to communicate better. He wouldn't hallucinate. That's another common, as I don't know if you're familiar, Robin Williams had Lewy body. It's a really dreadful diagnosis. And that's why people believe he took the way out he did. And I think Bruce Willis might have it now. I've heard differing reports, but it's a cruel illness where you lose control of all of your limbs, ataxia sets in. But I remember he wasn't allowed to have too much sugar. So I would sneak him in Frappuccinos and he would try to communicate and be like, next time sneak in a beer. So and I remember we would sit in the day rooms of his hospital and we'd watch things, lots of Eddie Murphy films because those were his favorite.
Good taste, your dad.
Yes, he loved George Carlin, Jim Carrey. He was always into Austin Powers as one of his favorite films. He just loved stupid comedies. So there were moments he was still there. So I regret that dance took me away from having a normal childhood with friends. I mean, my first high school, I absolutely loved. I had, you know, a lot of friends. There was even, it was a public school, but we had an equestrian team because we were near West Point. So they let us ride the West Point horses, which was sick. But when I entered the Ailey School and dance just became my sole focus, I felt, and I'm sure a lot, and you can probably relate to this too, I felt like I sacrificed having a normal childhood and not, or teenagehood. And not only that, but I also sacrificed that last time I could have spent with my dad. So it's a bit mixed. And I think for me, when I'm grieving, the best thing for me to do is to stay overly occupied. So for instance, after my dad died, I took one day off of school and that was it. And then I went straight back, which was both a blessing and a curse because I didn't have time to grieve and process things. I should have gone to, you know, one of those grief camps for kids or something like that and gotten a grief counselor. But it kept me occupied because perhaps as someone with, as an adult diagnosed with ADHD, I always need my dopamine going. And as a workaholic, that's how I get a lot of those feel good chemicals, that and eating lots of Nutella.
Yeah. That sounds like you have a lot of like stuff in the right place at this point, honestly. Like it sounds incredibly healthy. I definitely, man, there's so much about your story. You're right. I totally understand why other podcasts you've done have gone on and on because there's so many little things that I want to crack open. But I think the thing that's most interesting to me as you tell your story is that your awareness of how your experiences have affected your choices seems to be high. A lot of people are just moving from thing to thing. They're choosing what they want. And maybe those choices are based in a more immediate thought or impulse, but you so clearly have a profound awareness of how bigger themes and bigger events have affected you on bigger arcs in your life. And I think that that's an incredibly healthy thing. So while you didn't go to a grief camp or maybe should have, it sounds like you ended up with a pretty healthy attitude about the entire thing and a very hyper aware sense of yourself about all of this. And, you know, the other big thing that I hear you said a few times that really goes off in my head, and I don't think I've had this thought before, but you said it's like a blessing and a curse about a few things. And of course, I think we all know that expression. But if you notice, people tend to say that around a tragedy. Not a lot of like, I mean, occasionally they'd be like, fame, it's a blessing and a curse. Like there's a few things that maybe are inherently sound good and someone's like, hey, there's a dark side. But a lot of times you say a blessing and a curse, I feel like a lot of times you're talking about things that you're trying to deal with. And if that's the case and you manage to find a blessing amongst the curse, that's a fucking win. Like that's a huge win because of course there's a curse. Like you're dealing with the fact that your dad passed away and you liked him and that sucks. That's your curse. It's there. You're going to feel like shit because of it, and there's no avoiding it. If you can also find a blessing and also find a way to cope and also add on something fucking positive to that nightmare, you've won, because you're not going to like erase the tragedy with anything. Nothing. Nothing you do is going to make that just like vanish from thin air, you know? So like, I don't know. You could have gone to camp, but I think you took yourself to camp.
Yes. Well, actually, in that summer, I started taking classes online because I had hoped to graduate from UNCSA early. So I started the summer courses then. But yeah, and that's very true. It is typically associated with the tragedy. And thank you for saying that. Maybe it's all the drugs that have fried my brain, but I have been, I've had many opportunities, or maybe one of my many metaphysical clients, because out of my 35 clients, about 8 of them are in the metaphysical space, including 2 shamans. So if you need a shaman, let me know.
Can you,
you need a healer? They do distance Reiki too, or any sort of psychic reader. Do you need a Wiccan for a cord cutting? Give me a call. I have all the metaphysical clients you might need.
What does metaphysical mean for anyone listening who's like, what was all that stuff she just said?
Oh, okay.
I totally followed all of it, like every single thing. But if like somebody was watching or listening and like, what? Like, explain it for them.
Well, when we go into how I literally stumbled into marketing, how I stumbled into it, then you'll understand how I ended up in this niche space.
Okay. I'll be patient. But, tell me the story. Let's go.
Essentially metaphysical new age. So think of it as energy healers, psychic mediums, metaphysical stores. Like if you remember Kindred Spirits in Winston-Salem.
I do remember that. Store.
So a lot of my clients are metaphysical stores, crystal shops, the readers within those stores, things
like that. Cynical people might call it hippy dippy shit.
It's very hippy dippy shit.
I say it just to balance out anyone listening who's lost by the jargon, but I'm with you. I'm with you 100%. And that sounds really cool. Let's go back just a touch in time, and then we're going to get to that, cause it sounds like it's coming up soon. So ballet, dance, school for dance, but you're in this headspace of all the stuff that's going on with you that we just talked about. You emerge from the program, right? And when you leave, day one, we can start there. Like day one, you're out of school, diploma in hand, whatever. You're walking on into the world. Are you still like, let's dance? Or are you like, I'm fucking done with that? Or I'm like, what's the thought process on that? Because that's my main question too, to a lot of people leaving conservatory. You probably just spent over a decade learning how to do something. A lot of people hit that first step out the door and they're like, fuck that. I don't like that. Like, I don't want to do it anymore. I'm tired. Are you still wanting to dance? Where are your ambitions at that point?
Yeah, well, I'll preface and say that I was in the school of dance. First, I started as a contemporary major because I come from the Ailey School. It was a modern background, but it was a lot of Graham and Horton. And I wasn't a fan of all the pedestrian postmodern contemporary movements. So I switched the ballet program. And then all of a sudden, I'm the modern dancer in the ballet program. So that was fun. But
a dancer without a home.
Yes. Well, that's the thing, because at Ailey, I would have 4 classes every day, 2 ballet classes and then 2 modern classes or perhaps a rehearsal. So I was always used to being trained equally in both. So when I had to choose and specialize, it was incredibly challenging for me. And I understand UNCSA is unique in conservatories and that it's all about hyper specialization. But what I found, even as a professional in the field I'm in now, having as much diverse training, at least in my case, is really ideal. So, so when I finished up at UNCSA, I was like, I don't really know what to do with my life. I was having
what
a
year
lot
is
of,
this?
I was part of the class of 2017, but because I was having some mental health issues, I left in 2016. And then finally, they sent over my diploma because they counted my Ailey credits for dance credits because I had already fulfilled the academic requirements. And by the time they had processed that, the 2017 graduation had already passed. So they're like, oh,
so you had kind of a murky thing with credits and yeah.
So I was like, okay, so I'm class of 2017, but I left in 2016, but I got my diploma in 2018. So my name's on the 2018, graduation program. So it's very confusing.
What do you want? You know what, Chloe, I'm going to leave it up to you. What do you want me to write on the title of this episode? What class are you in, girl? You tell me.
Can you fit in nebulous glass?
we'll figure it out. We'll make a call.
X, like four X's.
There
glass.
You go.
20XX glass.
It was a metaphysical year.
It was. I'm sure. Well, actually, especially 2016. That was a year for everyone, wasn't it? But
sure.
That was an era. That was an unfortunate era, or at least fall of 2016. I finish up at UNCSA and I start doing all these unpaid internships, mostly in dance organizations, like Perry Dance, and Mark Morris. And that was incredibly stressful, because my mom, she was a forensic psychologist, master's level. And in 2009, one of her patients tried to kill her. So, she's been disability since. And of course my dad, for me to continue with my story of how I stumbled into marketing, I have to go back to my dad's story. So my dad was a huge marketer. He was at one point one of the wealthiest men in Westchester County. And he, you know, his parents came through Ellis Island. He was the first one in his family born in a tenement in Brooklyn.
To Ellis from where?
From Northern Ireland and Liverpool. They were
incredibly— That's my background.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. My heritage is all the way to Liverpool specifically, like way back.
Yeah. My great grandmother was a prostitute in Liverpool. So they were definitely, dirt poor. And it's believed my grandmother could have been Irish traveler. So they come over here for, better life. They live in this really shoddy tenement and that now probably costs $5 million.
Right.
And my dad, he enlisted in World War II. He joined the Navy because, quote, he didn't want to die. And he thought his best chances would be in the Navy.
Wow.
That particular war.
Yeah.
Well, he had gone to Brooklyn Tech. So he was really bright. He was kind of the golden child of the family. And another reason he loved being in the Navy was he was on a medicinal ship. He was a navigator since he had, you know, gone to a specialized high school, and his concentration at Brooklyn Tech was, I think, chemistry. So since he was scientifically minded, they made him one of the navigators. And he just loved flirting with, and his bravado, sleeping with the nurses on the ships. Anyway, he uses the GI Bill to go to Brown, where he's also like a crazy partier, slamming cars into trees and stuff, cars that weren't his, because he had never learned to drive living in the city. So his friend once was intoxicated and made him the designated driver of his brand new 1940s, whatever car. And my dad slammed into a tree. So at his reunions, he would proudly remark that, oh, that's my tree. And then from Brown, he went to the Wharton School, University of Pennsylvania, and then he got his business certificate at Harvard, even though Harvard people don't consider people who get a business certificate there to be Harvard alumni. It's kind of a thing. Then he went into marketing, he helped turn Massey Ferguson tractors around. He got the Clio, which is like the Tony's Oscar for marketing for his Eastern Airlines campaign. And then he had this idea, like, because my dad was this crazy creative genius. After he died, I found a whole 300 page opera to Edgar Allan Poe's, it's not The Tall Tale Heart. It's a different one. But anyway, he wrote a 300 page opera because he was like a madman. But one of his ideas was that he wanted to have an actual painter paint a Boeing 727 and a DC-8 as part of an organic marketing campaign. And he got Alexander Calder, the famous modern artist, to do it for $100,000 in 1973. And it was just a complete success for Brand of International Airways, because every person that looked up at the sky and saw this flying masterpiece was considered a view or a reach. So that was what he was most proud of in life as a marketer. So he has all this experience. He has his own agency that Mary Wells Lawrence, who called him a marketing super talent, she ends up buying from him. She was one of the first women to be considered to be added to the Forbes 400 as a CEO. She was one of the biggest marketers in history. Well, she's still alive. She's like 93. She's one of the biggest marketers in history. Her famous campaigns are like Flip Your Bic, I Heart New York, which has now become We Heart New York City. I don't want to get into that branding catastrophe. You can look it up, Google it, We Heart New York City. They got rid of the I Heart New York. So anyway, she buys my dad's agency. He's living the good life, you know, Scarsdale, Westchester, very wealthy area. If you're not familiar with Westchester, big mansion, maids quarters, lots of affairs. And then he decides to create his own airline. And that fails miserably.
Wait, is your dad Don Draper?
Actually, Don Draper is an agglomeration of different marketing executives. So in a way, yes, because antics all
of course.
He's one of the many marketers that went into that character. Amalgamation.
Got it.
And so,
Dad's a madman.
He was a really successful madman. That was his life. That was his, everything about him. He was this natural salesman who had to make everything really entertaining. Sure. Probably also had ADHD, but
sounds like it.
He went $22 million in debt in 1993, which is a lot more money now. And I was born in 1995. So by the time I was born, he was completely, bankrupt. And so he died penniless. And so my mom and I were surviving off of just her, you know, social security, disability checks and, some of the early.
What happened, Chloe? Can you talk about that? How did he lose all his money? That's a lot.
I don't even really know the details since they preceded my birth and I always get them wrong. My mom listened to one of my podcast interviews and she's like, you got all the facts wrong. That wasn't it.
Okay. I'll give you some room there. Yeah.
But no, essentially what he did, he had this idea, his airline was called East Hampton Air, and it was based in the Hamptons on Long Island, and it was to take people specifically from the Hamptons to other regional airports. I believe that's right. I hope my mom doesn't criticize me. So think like Piedmont International, that one's still, that was like a small airport, or Stewart Airport, if you're familiar with the Hudson Valley. It was actually a good idea because there wasn't an airline, I don't think at that time, just for smaller regional airports. But he decided, because he was very cocky, to make all these huge investments. And instead of having, I guess, his board guarantee them, he personally guaranteed all the loans. And that's really what killed him. He shouldn't have personally guaranteed.
Right.
So there was some sort of...
He put everything on the line and it didn't work out. That's what happened.
Yeah, he was a huge risk taker. And there was some sort of recession or airline crash. I mean, there were a lot of airline bankruptcies at that time. Braniff went bankrupt in 82. Braniff 2 then went bankrupt. And then Braniff 3 went bankrupt. And one of my clients is Braniff International, hence why I know everything about Braniff. Then Pan Am went bankrupt. Eastern went bankrupt. It was just a horrible time for airlines. So my dad chose, I think, the worst time also to try to start a new airline because deregulation killed the airline industry. He went into major debt. I was actually the first place I ever lived that started the 18 plus moves was the guest house of his former mansion that had already been foreclosed. And by the time I was 2, that one was also foreclosed. So I've been a renter, ever since. It was really hard when I was an unpaid intern, out of UNCSA for me and my mom. We relied on food pantries because I wasn't making any income at that time. And finally, I get my first dance company position. As I said before, even though I have all this training, I never had like the ideal ballet body. I'm quite short. I'm muscular. I'm not naturally flexible. I've had to work for all my flexibility. And I dance like a man, as I'm told. I love jumping and turning. And that's not really great if you're trying to be dainty and if you're in a company that relies on a lot of point work. So I finally get a dance company position because I won't say much about the dance training at UNCSA. I'll just say that I had to be retrained. So I had to take classes with the 12-year-olds, which was very humbling. My company director, she completely broke me down again, which made me feel like, wow, I just wasted all this money on this degree. And I danced there for 3 years. She was paying $11 an hour, which was Westchester minimum wage at the time. And my mom and I were still kind of struggling. So I had helped out here. I moved here to Peekskill, New York, which is my pride and joy. I adore Peekskill. So everyone should look into it because it's awesome. So I moved here to Peekskill and there's this little arts studio called Antonia Arts. And I was like, that sounds like Dolly Dinkle's dance studio. Like you need an adult name if you're trying to appeal to adults. So I suggested she changed it to the artist spot, and I just did some basic admin help for her, just for some extra money. And I created these new artist spot social media accounts because the name changed. And the Instagram artist spot account got 600 followers in its first week. And then that caught the attention of her friend, Anita, whose sister is Pat Riley, the deputy mayor here. And Anita has this Italian-American caricature called Patty with her acting partner, Marilyn Matarese, who has an Italian-American caricature called also called Patty. So they are Patty and Patty. And they're like, hey, you know, we've had these characters for 10 years. We've been on YouTube. We have like, I don't even think they had 1,000 YouTube followers. They only have like 1,000 Facebook followers after 10 years. And they were like, hey, can you help us with our socials like you did for Scarlett? And I was like, sure. So they were my first clients. And they're like, oh, there's this TikTok thing, because this was 2019. Why don't we get on that? And I was like, sure. So I created their TikTok. They had 11 Instagram followers. And now they have 1.25 million followers across Instagram and TikTok, with 885,000 on TikTok, 190,000, I think, on Instagram, and then 115,000 on Facebook. And then from there, other people were like, can you help us? And I was like, sure, because I need the money. I'm barely making, you know, $400 a month dancing, and my point shoes cost a fortune. So I continued dancing. We even got to tour in Martinique, which was cool, but right before the pandemic hit. So I was able to actually focus more into the social, lean more into the social media work. People were home. That was kind of a boon time for social media, especially for TikTok. And then one client became two. My second one was actually Braniff International, the Braniff Airways Foundation, which keeps the memory of Braniff alive. So, which I got connected with them because I wanted to donate my dad's paperwork, which was kind of the only thing he left me, about Braniff. And they're like, I was like, hey, I'm having success on TikTok with this account. Why don't I create a TikTok for you? And I did. So I get to honor, I got to do videos about my dad as, you know, the head of advertising, briefly at Braniff, who brought in, you know, Calder, he brought in Halston to Braniff and all this stuff. And then, yeah, I went from two clients, to six, to 12, to 24, to 35, and it'll probably reach 40 by the end of the week if I continue onboarding the Yorktown legislative slate.
That's really fucking cool. So like, you're like a mad woman now.
Yeah, that's why it's wild, because my dad used to always say, because my dad was the stay-at-home dad when I was growing up, since he just retired,
right.
And my mom worked crazy hours, so she was never really home. I spent obviously a lot, he was always the only guy in amongst the sea of mothers waiting for me to finish my dance classes at the dance studios, driving me here, there, and everywhere, driving my friends here, there, and everywhere. So he would always tell me, because we spent so many hours together, you're going to have your own marketing agency one day, just like I did. And I was like, no, I'm not. I guess I was too young at the time. I must've been like 10. I couldn't even imagine like what that entailed. All I knew was that I was artistic and I wanted to do something, arts related. I was also really athletic, so I didn't want a desk job. Then after that, he got sick. And it just never occurred to me to go into marketing. I even thought, once I retire from dance, I'll teach dance or I'll become an arts administrator because I like writing grants and stuff. But it never at all, even though that was his life and his whole identity. And looking back, he was training me all along. Like, we used to spend a lot of time in graveyards, which I'm a very morbid person, so I loved it. I remember being like 4 years old, and we would walk around, and he'd have me calculate the ages of the deceased when they died to help with my math skills. And then we would create stories around the names of the deceased. So if there was, for instance, there was a father son. So we'd try to create these fictional versions of their lives and how they might have ended up there. And he was always giving me these little creative exercises like, hey, Chloe, sell me this Coca-Cola, and handing it to me. When we went to parties together, we would put on parlor performances together. Another thing he would do is he would watch commercials with me, and he would tell me, okay, that's boring. Don't you like, that's horrible. But that is brilliant. So it's weirdly poetic. It's kind of sad at the same time, I guess. that I've fallen inadvertently into marketing. It just comes so innately to me. It comes so much more easily to me than dance. And I've made it farther in the marketing world in a year than I made it in 10 years in dance.
What's
and
I'm sad just, about that, Chloe?
Well, it's sad that I'm essentially, my dad's whole dream in life with his five kids was to have one operate a successful marketing agency and continue his legacy. That was his dream. And I had kind of convinced myself that I wasn't going to do that. So sorry, Dad. So it's a bit of, it's poetic, but it's also, yeah, it's kind of poetically tragic that I'm now fulfilling dreams for me and he's not here. Especially because I'm like, oh my God, he would know exactly how to market this thing. Or what would he say about this? And I often wish I still had his input and mentorship, but I'm really grateful. Perhaps I didn't get the quantity with him, but I got a lot of quality time with him. So I can often, sometimes I'll go to his grave like a mad person and I'll just sit there talking to it like, okay, so how do we promote this short-term rental operating software? What is a creative way of doing this? It's very unsexy, so.
That's fucking beautiful, man. Honestly, and let me offer just a slightly a different perspective as someone who's fully objective. Like, I don't know you. I mean, I like you, and it sounds like I really would have fucking liked your dad. But let me point out a couple of things that I think are really important here. You said your dad was born in 1926?
Yep, November 19th.
What your father came to understand about a marketing agency is completely different than what a marketing agency is now. So whether or not his dream is realized is up to you and everybody in the family and whether or not you even care about whether or not that happens. However, I think from everything I've just heard from you, and you could tell me because you knew him and I didn't, I think your dad would be super fucking proud of you. Like the details about an agency or, you know, it working the way it used to, or if you're like the new Gary Vaynerchuk or somebody, like none of that. What matters is you found the fucking thing that makes you happy. You like this and you're better at it than the thing you spent your whole life doing. And he fucking knew that shit from the get-go. And he was like, go dance, whatever. Fine. I support you. I'll pick you up every day. But I can already tell where you're going. And I know that because I've been watching people care about this and do it and practice it and do great at it and fuck it up for like a really long time. And there's a bit, I guess, of a kind of dark poetic beauty to the fact that he's not around, because in order for him to have all that experience to give you, he can only live so long. He's a person. He's born in 1926. He'd be almost 100 years old if he were still here. Like, and dude, Marilyn, that's crazy. That's crazy. Like you can't have all of it in a weird way. You got so much of it because you didn't get your dad at 30, which is what most of us get. You got your dad with a whole fucking two families, a career, lost the career. He lived a full goddamn life and a half before you even showed up. And as a result, you get the benefit of that. It's like some people who get raised by their grandparents have a very different attitude about life, and they have a different perspective about work and community and all that stuff. And you talk to them and you're like, man, you just seem really like connected to people. And they're like, yeah, the people who raised me were fucking 60. Like they'd been through it. They weren't a pissed off 26-year-old who's like, this fucking kid, I can't go to the bar. That's a totally different life. Like, and you ended up with this very specific experience that I think it's so clearly rubbed off on you in all the best ways. And man, I think if I know anything about your dad, which I don't, like I said, I never met the guy. I just listened to you talk about him for an hour. That's it. If I was him, I'd be proud as shit. Cause I'd be like, you're crushing it. You're literally crushing it. And it's all working out. Like, I don't know. That's like very inspiring to me, Chloe. I think you should. I mean, it's okay to see a little darkness, but that's like all light to me. To me, that story is all light. Because he won. He's not even here and he's winning.
Yeah, I found a four leaf clover today. I found 15 over the past year. I just like spot them randomly because it was so nice outside today. I love going up this haunted hill because, again, I feel very safe in haunted spaces for some reason. It's a former Revolutionary War battle site. So I'm doing my usual hike there. One of my clients, who's a psychic, refuses to go up there. She's like, Chloe, you're crazy. I'm not going near that damn hill. I was like, okay, but I love it there. I have my little forest friends. I saw a sparrowhawk today. I know that because, well, one of my clients is Wildlife Rescue India, which they actually just went to the Oscars and they lost for any UNCSA kids who went to the Oscars this year. The film was All That Breathes. It's on HBO Max still. Go watch it about their efforts. Yeah, I have a lot of crazy clients all over the world. But anyway, thank you for saying that. That was really beautiful. And I feel like when I find those four leaf clovers, and I started finding them for the first time, I'd never found four leaf clover in my life until I found a five leaf clover last May. And it was while I was still dancing professionally. And I'd just been invited to the Cannes Film Festival with the Wildlife Rescue India guys for All That Breathes, which won for Best Documentary, the Golden Eye Award at Cannes. And it also won at Sundance and the Cinema Award and stuff. But it lost BAFTA and the Oscar to Navalny. And I saw that. And that's when I went on hiatus from my dance company because I love my dance company director. She retrained me, like I said, but she was, you know, an intense, stereotypical French company director. And the last thing she told me in rehearsal was that I was lazy, stubborn, and developing a muffin top. And so after that rehearsal, I don't know why she was like particularly on my case that day. But of all days, because that's when I'd received the news that, you know, that I had this great opportunity to go to the Cannes Film Festival. So I go up to her after and I'm like, Madame, because we had to call her Madame. So I want to go to the Cannes Film Festival. I'm going to take a week off in 2 weeks. Is that okay? And she freaks out, starts screaming at me in multiple languages per usual. And I think she wants me to cry like I usually do. But then when I cry, she accuses me of, you know, manipulating with my tears. Anyway, she was... I really loved her work because it was classical ballet, but occasionally we did more modern works imbued with Afro-Caribbean because she was Martinican.
Cool, but she's mean.
Fun and challenging. But it was really demanding. We were working for minimum wage, but she expected us to stay overtime, even during COVID. And during COVID, since we were performing outdoors, we would actually have to set up the stage ourselves. So I would dance for... but she turned me into a dancer like I never thought I would be. I mean, she was really harsh, but she turned me into something UNCSA, ALE, they could never do. She literally remolded my entire body. So when I left, it was May of 2022 that I went on my hiatus from my dance company that I'm still on. So I could go to the Cannes Film Festival. And then from there, I went on to Egypt, Kuwait, London, Paris, I'm forgetting some places, for social media work to collect native organic content for other clients and stuff. All in the past, like I said. So I literally went just with an iPhone 11 and desperation. I went from having nothing to working for corporations, working for celebrities, creating influencers from scratch. Like I've done that with four different influencers. So from zero, and working with all these amazing small businesses, nonprofits, musicians, artists. I still work with a lot of dance studios and I occasionally will perform with them, but it's free. Like I performed yesterday at the Peekskill Rotary Luncheon. I didn't charge anything and it was just really freeing. I didn't have that pressure. I didn't worry that I'd come off stage and hear "Qu'est-ce que vous faites?"
I try to tell as many artists as possible that whoever you need it from, the universe, yourself, whatever, I hope you get permission to be great at an art for nothing. You can be great at it. I mean, one of the best, like you bust out your violin in public and people are like, God damn, were you a fucking prodigy? And you're like, yeah. And like, oh, do you do that for a living? No. Just fun. I'm just awesome at it. Like, that's okay. That's okay. We can work 15 years on an art form or a skill set, develop it, be great at it. And it doesn't have to pay our bills. You pay your bills with something fucking else. It's okay. You're not a failure because of that. You just are good at a lot of things. Isn't that crazy that we as artists develop tremendous skill in something? And then when it doesn't pay our bills, or even if we just choose to pay our bills with something else, people are like, you're a failure. Like, I'm a failure. I'm fucking better at this thing than most people who ever try to do it. What do you mean a fail? I am talented. Like, what do you mean? It's not whether or not you can sell it. That's your job. Now, that's what you're doing, is whether or not you can sell it. Sometimes it's okay to just be dope at something and like, let that bring you joy. It feels good to do something and be good at it, to dance and be connected to the music and the people in the space and your body, and like to sing and hit the note and do that. Like, that feels good. Isn't that enough for some of us to be like successful, you know?
Oh yeah, I love some of my clients, because like I said, I have a bunch of clients here in downtown Peekskill and in the surrounding areas. So I literally went from one Chamber of Commerce breakfast where I was filming a bunch of clients there to this Rotary luncheon where not only was I performing, but I also had two other clients there. The clients were there, and some of them went to Egypt with me, because one of my clients who performed in Egypt, in Kuwait, she's a Rotarian. So a bunch of Rotary people actually went all the way to Giza to see her perform. And that was, as someone who could never afford air travel growing up, traveling across the Atlantic for the first time, well, consciously, I don't count. When my dad, before he lost completely everything when I was a few months old, he took my mom to Paris, but I don't count that because I wasn't conscious. So my first time consciously crossing the Atlantic was last year. And the first thing that happened was that my luggage was stolen by a taxi driver who drove off with it in the trunk in Paris. So that was fun. That was a great, that's why I'm not a big fan of Paris. I love London. I spent like a whole month last year in London. I fell in love with London. I loved Egypt. I didn't spend any time in like a fancy resort or anything. I was on the streets of Cairo with the pole donkeys, the goats, all the sad stray dogs, which really broke my heart. But I spent a lot of time with my friend who's a Yemeni refugee and other Yemeni refugees. And that was just beautiful, doing a lot of folk dancing, belly dancing. Kuwait was interesting because it's like Dubai, Kuwait City. I'm happy I experienced that. But anyway, I've had all these opportunities that dance would have never afforded. And I don't think I'd be able to sustain my own agency if I didn't have the discipline that dance gave me. And the reason people hire me is that my focus is, and I'm an organic marketer. I do inorganic stuff like Facebook ads, but where I really shine is just creating content that's so creative and engaging and utilizes the three E's of successful organic social media content, which is, it's either empowering, educational, and or entertaining. I create such engaging content that it hooks people in, and it creates a loyal audience and without paying a dime. And the algorithms are like, wow, this is fabulous. Let's blast it out to millions of people. So my content has received over 250 million views. Like I said, I've created a lot of influencers and viral content from scratch, and all my ability to take a trend, be it an evergreen trend or a more ephemeral passing or Flickr trend, and adapt it for each client in each niche, whether they be a print shop or an outreach nonprofit, or a musician, or a mortgage broker, a real estate agent, or a politician, the ability to take something from that, a trend, and adapt it for a niche takes so much creativity. And I wouldn't be as successful at that if I didn't have the artist training and artist background. And that's why I lately have been getting jobs over people with actual marketing degrees. I do have some insecurities and a bit of imposter syndrome regarding having a BFA versus having like a BS in something, but like in marketing or business. But what I found is what I offer as an artist is so much more valuable than that person that comes from the traditional print marketing space.
I got hired, my first job out of school that was like full-time paying job was at Comedy Central in integrated marketing. And I had come from the school of drama. Like, I was a directing student. Like, I knew how to direct fucking streetcar. Like, that's what I went to college for. And my first job was at Comedy Central and Spike, formerly Spike TV, it's Paramount now. But back then, I got that job over a bunch of film student grads, over a bunch of marketing grads. And I was a like theater dork who was like just really excited about TV and didn't know shit about how it worked. And I got that job for a bunch of reasons I've talked about on this podcast before. but mainly because at the end of the day, and this is the thing that you know so deep in your soul that I'm sure you can articulate it a million ways, but this is so clearly baked into your understanding of people. Marketing, selling, whatever version of whatever you want to call it, is really just about getting people's attention and then not wasting it. And when you do that, the easiest way to do that is to tell them a story. It's the easiest way to do it. And storytelling is its own thing that almost every artist has to learn how to do. Filmmaker, dancer, singer, whatever. If you don't learn how to tell a story, beginning, middle, and end, here's a thing. This happened to it. Then good night. Like, if you don't learn how to fucking do that in 10 seconds, in 2 hours, in 10 years, whatever your size of your story is, you're smoked. You're totally smoked. And there's so many jobs. You want to be a good trial lawyer? You can't tell a story. You're fucked. You can't, like, you have to learn that. And there's so many, the cool thing about storytelling is, like I just mentioned, there's like 30 vehicles to learn how to do that. Learn it through song, learn it through dance, learn it through theater, film, television, whatever, comedy. But if you learn that skill set, it applies to so many other things, almost everything we do that has to do with communication, marketing. And in this day and age, I think we can all agree, marketing is the thing that everyone is really talking about when they talk about almost anything else. All this, like, oh, the social media is having this effect on us, or the phones, or all of that comes from marketing. All of that centers around the fact that there are people out there who want to make money. And in order to do that, they need to get people's attention. And then when they get it, they don't want to waste it. So they need to hire fucking Chloe to make sure to at least do the second thing right. And if they can't figure out the first thing, they need you for that shit too. And you're going to do that. Correct me if I'm wrong, but you're going to do that by telling a fucking story to the audience and then hoping they fucking like it. You've got enough experience to know what gets their attention, what keeps it, all of that kind of stuff. You put that together with an organic, real story about that brand. And it's weird because you say it and it's simple. And then to execute it is so challenging for so many people. That's why, wow, you have a job.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's why I'm in such high demand now, because everyone's realized, wait, so social media, it's kind of taking over. Most of my clients are boomers who are like, what is this TikTok thing? but what you said is completely accurate. Something my dad always used to say was that, you know, good marketers, well, creativity is the number one thing you need. And you need to be able to create things that are memorable, that people talk about after the fact. The New York Post has a good word for those types of stories, like those headlines that have people, you know, look up from their newspaper in the morning and go, hey, wife Martha, did you see this story about
right.
sex with a porn star and Stormy Daniels saying he had a small member? And you're right. We're in an attention economy, and I absolutely love making dopey TikToks and reels, because that's my focus, is short form video, because that has the highest reach and discoverability right now, organically, as everyone's trying to compete with TikTok and their addicting crack algorithm, which, as you mentioned, the reason it's so addictive is, why should you sit down for 2 hours to watch The Irishman when you can sit down for 2 hours and watch like 30 TikToks and get self-contained stories in each one? So you have that beginning, middle, and end. And you have that dopamine fix and hit with each one. And that discoverability and the For You page factor has just been completely life-changing for my clients. Even my local clients who don't perhaps have the largest vanity metrics or followers, like local retail businesses and things like that. It's just amazing to see their following is so loyal. People actually come up to me and they're like, wait, aren't you the girl that shows up in those videos? I often don't always film myself. I prefer not being the face of accounts, but occasionally I have to. And it's funny when I'm actually recognized. My clients, Patty and Patty, have now been invited to huge movie premieres. They're going to one in Queens. It's actually, I think the film is called Somewhere in Queens. They've been featured on the Instagram main creator page. They make $1,000 now per sponsored ad. And that's all been, you know, they're two ladies in their 60s. They would have never figured out TikTok if it wasn't for me being right. Like, okay, so these are the trends, because what I do is I create trends list. So I have my evergreen trends, which, as you mentioned, are going to be compelling story times, evergreen. So things that we can always turn back to. POVs, ratings and rankings, transformation videos, which also show the beginning, middle, and end and are always appealing. And then I have the Flickr or ephemeral trends, like those, you know, the dopey trending audios. It's corn.
Right.
And I love watching those and being like, wait, what crazy thing can I do with this audio? When I was in Egypt, I just have so much fun filming people. It brings me such joy. I had my client who's this violinist with their 250-year-old, probably hundreds of thousands of dollars, crazy expensive violin. I had her, she had never ridden a horse before. I was like, you know what? I want to get you on a white stallion, a white Arabian stallion in front of the Great Pyramid of Giza in a dress with your violin. And violins aren't allowed in that pyramid complex. So we had to have a very trustworthy kid sneak it in, sneak it past the guards.
Wow. Doing some Assassin's Creed stuff over here.
We got the coolest video ever of her playing the violin on, even though she wasn't wearing the right undergarment. She forgot to wear underwear. It was like, oh my God, it was such a nightmare. But anyway, so her first time on a horse, underwearless commando with her violin in this gorgeous golden black dress and her sunglasses. It's sick. But just like those things bring me such joy. And like I was trying to say, ADHD brain, actually one of my clients is an ADHD coach, so maybe she can help me. That the clients, even those with the lower vanity metrics, they'll come up to me and be like, oh my God, we had no reservations for this show. I'm referring to one of my clients that also it's a local cafe that has shows in the evening. They have salsa night tonight, so I'm excited. But when you started blasting things about the show, all of a sudden we got all these calls and we're sold out. I just sold out a 1,000 seat show. When I get calls from clients, where it's actually like real world metrics of them being like, oh, I keep getting all these gigs because people are like, you're inundating my social media. You're every, I mean, it just fills me, especially the nonprofits too. I've raised like over $250,000 through social media for my nonprofits. And it just fills me with such a level of fulfillment that I never got dancing. Maybe in my last, you know, my last Nutcracker performance, which was my last professional performance with my company, my director turns to me and she goes, Chloe, for the first time in years, you finally look like a professional dancer.
Ouch.
Thanks. And I think I did feel really fulfilled then, because I finally was like, okay, I'm at the peak of my abilities. I feel like I can't really get any better than this. So after those, that's why I think it was easy for me to, people are like, oh, it's been so hard, your passion to transition out of dance. Don't you miss it? And I'm like, no.
Right. That's so like easy. People who are like, I'm so sorry you got divorced. And you're like, I'm not. It's great. You misunderstood the situation. You're judging my life by your standards. Nah, that's why you don't get it. Chloe, I'm so glad that you took the time to talk to me today. I had a blast. I have like a billion more questions for you actually, now that I've gotten the story, but I think I'm going to save it until the next time you come on the show, which I think should be not that super far away. And we'll catch up on a bunch of stuff, 'cause I want your opinion on short form versus long form content and how, where we're going and what we're doing and all that kind of stuff. I have so many questions, but we'll get to it next time so that we can really dig into it. How's that sound?
Oh, that sounds fabulous. Thank you so much for having me. Yeah. And like, I kind of warned you, my life, even the person, I just got an iPhone 14 Max Pro because it has 4K, which is fabulous. If you're recording stuff. And the Verizon worker was like, wow, you're a really interesting person. 'Cause he's like, who needs a 1 terabyte 14 Max Pro who's already used up 700 gigabytes in their 13 Pro? Max Pro. And I'm like, well, it's because I record 1,000 videos and photos every single day for dozens of people. But yeah, and I'll just leave you with this one quick social media TikTok tip. As you mentioned, eyeballs are the most important thing. Watch time retention is the number one main metric you have to pay attention to, even though it's not available right now on Insights for most accounts for Instagram Reels and Facebook Reels. But if you could do anything, I would say, just spend 5 minutes every day Going through your Reels and TikTok feed, seeing, getting a sense of what's popular, and then playing around, because a lot of organic growth is trial and error. That's why it can take up to 6 months to have your first viral video, because you have to prove yourself to the algorithm that you're creating such engaging content that it's worthy of going viral. It'll get them eyes, which mean more eyes on advertising dollars, which means more money for them, and they're greedy as hell. So just play around with different short form video formats within your niche. Make sure to always use a good hook. Don't do the millennial pause thing. It's horrible.
The
millennial pause. That comes from, I don't know if you remember back in the day, you had to wait a second for recordings to start, like on your webcam. It would be like 3, 2, 1, whatever. So now it's a thing, mostly on TikTok, that millennials will pause for a second because they unconsciously or subconsciously think that it's not recording yet. But what that does is, so the first 2 seconds of your video are actually nothing, you staring at the camera, and most people swipe away within the first 2 seconds. So it's really essential that you, that's when you put in a good hook. You do fun transitions to keep attention. You do whatever you need to do. If you need to dress up your dog like a firefighter, do it. If you need to cover yourself in nothing but stickers, do it. Do whatever outrageous thing will get people from not swiping away from your video. You do that enough, you'll go organically viral. Hopefully you'll have good click-through rates and lead generation from that, whatever your objectives are. And then ideally you'll have some client and customer conversions. So yeah, play around with short form video, good hooks, transitions, keep it fun.
Oh, and take never the lessons, folks. Anything you hate. Never what?
Never post anything you hate. Never hate post. Never post anything you feel obligated to. If you have like a, if you're in the middle of the subway and you're like, oh my God, I have this brilliant idea for a video, just like whip your phone out and quickly take it. Don't worry about batching things or recording multiple things at once. Just let inspiration hit you, because when you actually, and when also be super energetic and like almost like a silent film star, be overly exaggerated, like be hyperbolic, have a fainting couch, do your thing. Live your best life, get a stripper pole, put on a mascot costume, just create things that keep people engaged, empowered, and educated. Lots of fun fact videos. 3 things I love about my favorite meeting, or unpopular opinion, or 3 green flags, 3 red flags, things like that. Anyway, we'll have to save this for another one.
We will. We're going to do the full class. Thank you, Chloe, so much. I really appreciate it.
No, thank you so much, and have a wonderful rest of your week and weekend.
You too, everybody out there. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you learned something. We'll see you next time.